The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. And I'd like to welcome to the program today Anne Weisgarber. Hello, Anne.
Hello, Vic.
Anne, you've put out a new novel. It's called The Glove Maker. How did you get the idea for this story?
Well, you know, actually, it goes back a good ways. My husband and I were on vacation in Utah at Capitol Reef National Park. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not.
You're not? Oh, you'll have to go. It's a beautiful, beautiful area, but there's a small little town in the park that's called Fruta, and there are orchards that were planted by the first settlers, and the National Park Service keeps these orchards going. And when we were there, they had ladders in the orchards so that visitors could pick apples. And so I was doing that, picking apples, and then I just started thinking about who were these people who planted the first orchards? Because this area is so isolated, I just couldn't imagine. And one thing led to another over many, many years. I just started doing research, and here we are with a book.
Is there something special about this area where it's easier to grow that kind of thing? Don't they have to irrigate or something?
They do, and the original irrigation ditches are still there. The Park Service keeps those up. But this is it's an interesting part of because the surrounding area is very, very stark. And in fact, in the book, it's referred to as the wastelands. Mm. And it was very stark. But this is a little, like almost an oasis, mm-hmm. that's surrounded by the red rock buttes. And the buttes trap the sun, so it's a little bit warmer. And this is where the Sulphur Creek and the Fremont River converge. And so there is water. But, yes, the early settlers dug these irrigation ditches. And one of the constant things that they had to do was every winter the ditches would collapse, and so they would have to redig them again. Mm. But the book does deal with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as many people know them as the Mormons. But the Mormons had a practice of always planting fruit trees wherever they settled. And it was, you know, an opportunity for them to have fresh produce, but also they could sell the produce. So this was quite common in Utah, mm-hmm. to have orchards.
Your primary narrator in this is a woman named Deborah, who they refer to as Sister Deborah. And as we get further into the book, we discover another narrator, and we'll talk about him in a few minutes. Tell us about Deborah. How did you get the idea for this particular character?
Well, as you know, when I started, after having my little apple picking experience in the orchard, I started buying books about the area, and I stumbled across the name of a woman, and she was married, but she owned 20 acres of the orchards in her own name, which was unusual for that time. And so I was curious about her, so I started doing a little bit more research about her, and there's not a whole lot, but I discovered that she was married, but she didn't have any children. And her husband appeared to have just kind of disappeared. I couldn't find any records of him after a certain while. He wasn't in the census. I couldn't find a death certificate. I couldn't find a grave site for him. So she fascinated me because she was someplace in an isolated area. There were seven other families where she was living, but I just couldn't stop thinking about her. So she's the inspiration for the book.
She is your glove maker. The book is The Glove Maker. Anne Weisgarber has joined me on the program. And she's on the phone in the Houston area today. And Anne, when I was reading it, I thought, gosh, I don't know anything about this culture. And these people living in this isolated community, they were exiles in a way, weren't they?
Yes.
Tell us how that happened and what that meant.
Yes. You know, when I was doing the research, I realized that this community of Junction, that was called Junction at that time, today it's called Fruita, they've changed the name, but at Junction in the 1880s had been settled by people who just kind of trickled in one at a time. And usually at that time, the LDS Church, the Mormon Church, would send, you know, big parties. Well, not big, big parties, but maybe a party of 20 families to go settle an area. And they would go all at one time. And that was different in Junction. These people kind of trickled in. So evidence was beginning to look like they were not the normal Mormon settlers. And yet they identified as being Mormons. Or at that time, they referred to themselves as saints. So that made them different. And then I realized that they didn't have a ward house, which most Mormon communities did and still do. So that was different. And then I realized that they didn't have a bishop. And that was always like a religious leader that the community would vote on. At that time, that's changed now. But they would vote and have somebody, you know, kind of step in to help organize the community. And they didn't have that person either. So all the evidence was beginning to look like they were not practicing their faith, but yet they couldn't quite split from their faith all the way. They did stay together. So that all played into the story of who were these people.
Would a ward house be comparable to a church or a chapel?
It could be, or it could just be like a community center.
Okay.
But oftentimes the ward house would be part of the church building, and that would be where they would have all their meetings and all their get-togethers. Instead, in the little town of Junction, they did all their gatherings at a schoolhouse, which still exists today. You can visit it in the park, and it's tiny, tiny. It's so tiny, I don't know how all of them got in at one time. But the fact that they didn't have a bishop there just said a whole lot to me.
All right. So we've got this isolated community, just a few families over by an area that is very desolate, but this place where they are, they're growing orchards, they have fruit that they're producing, but they're sort of outcasts, they're sort of exiles. And in this community, Deborah is sort of an exile herself. She's not a typical settler. She doesn't have children, and her husband isn't there with her. Explain. Tell us without spoiling your story what this means.
Yes. You know, in the church, it was very important to have families, big families. And here is a woman who doesn't have any children, and historically, the woman I used for the inspiration didn't have children. And so I thought that just set her apart. And then in the book, she marries a man who has doubts about the church. And this begins to, kind of feed into her own doubts about the church. She does not like the practice of plural marriage, which is what the people at the time called it. They didn't call it polygamy. The church members didn't, but plural marriage, she didn't like it. And so that set her apart as well. And then her husband has gone missing. He's a wheelwright, and he travels to small towns in Utah and in northern Arizona to repair people's wheels, a very important job at that time. And he's not home when he's supposed to be. So here she is, a married woman without a husband and without children. So that made her very different.
And the fact that he leaves her alone like that, that is also unusual.
Yes, you know, Vic, you would think so. But when I was doing, digging in diaries, it was surprising how often women would be left on their own as their husbands would go off to support them in whatever way they could, or, you know, some of them would, you know, like during the Civil War, they joined to fight and they would be gone. So it seems unusual. We look back on it and think, how could these men do it? But it did happen.
Well, I guess I meant that she's truly alone. She doesn't have all those kids running around.
Right. Right. She is very alone. Yeah. And the person the story is based on, her sister and brother-in-law did live there in the community. So just as I have that in the book as well. So she's not completely alone. I couldn't have her all by herself.
Okay. You're listening to the Book Nook. We'll be right back. The book is The Glove Maker, and Weiss Garber wrote it. And we are recording this in advance and airing it on Saturday, February 9th, because Anne is going to be in Dayton this afternoon at 2 o'clock. She's got an event at the Dayton Metro Library, and that's over at 215 East 3rd Street in downtown Dayton. And she'll be at the Eichelberger Forum there. What's going on this afternoon? What have you got going?
Well, I'm so excited about this. Vic, this is my first event for The Glove Maker, and I can't think of a better place than to be in Dayton, my hometown where I grew up and went to high school. I grew up in Kettering. And so I'm so excited. And, of course, that library is just a showcase. And the best part for me is that I'm doing this event with Jess Montgomery, and whose recent novel, The Widows, and you had, you know, had her on your program as well. So we're going to be kind of doing a Q&A with each other. We'll talk a little bit about the challenges of writing historical fiction, some of the interesting discoveries that we made along the way, a little bit about the publication process, a little bit about the writing process. So the two of us will just be having a conversation.
You're going to interview each other?
Yes, Sharon and I know each other. In fact, we were just at a conference together about 2 weeks ago in Texas. So, I think we're just going to have a lot of fun.
Now, you just said Sharon, and you said you're going to be with Jess. I'm confused, Anne.
I'm confused, too, because, you know, we have Jess Montgomery, which is her pen name for her wonderful new book, The Widows, and then in her other life, she's known as Sharon Short.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And nothing to be sorry about. Easy to slip up that way. In fact, I've gotten emails from her before where she thought that she was Jess Montgomery instead of Sharon Short. I'm just kidding. Easy to do when you got a pen name.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And if you want to listen to my interview with Jess Montgomery for The Widows, after this interview concludes, you can go to our website at wyso.org, go to the Book Nook page, and you can listen to the podcast of my conversation with Jess Montgomery as you prepare to go to the Dayton Metro Library this afternoon to see Anne and Jess together at 2 o'clock. And that is downtown Dayton, 215 East 3rd Street. They'll be at the Eichelberger Forum. And I do understand that they want advanced registration if you can do it. So also go to their website, and you can register online at daytonmetrolibrary.org/events, or you can call them at 463-2665. So you can register. They want to know how many people are going to come. And even though that's this afternoon, I'm sure they'd appreciate you giving them a heads up. That's daytonmetrolibrary.org/events or 463-2665 to let them know that you're going to come out. All right, let's talk more about your protagonist. And then let's talk some more about the other part of the story, the gentleman who becomes one of your other narrators.
Sounds good.
Okay. You go for it. Tell us what's happening here.
Okay, well, the premise of the book is that it does take place in a very isolated area of Utah Territory in 1888, and it's during the winter time. And my apologies to all of you who are dealing with winter right now, because the book is also not going to make you any warmer. But it takes place in what is today's Capitol Reef, as I've talked about. And this was a time when the Mormon Church was under tremendous pressure. from the federal government, because one part of the church's theology was the practice of plural marriage. And the federal government called this polygamy. They were not keen on this at all, and it was a felony. So the government was determined to get rid of polygamy, so they began to crack down on men who had more than one wife. So these men would, some of the men would catch wind that they were, that deputies were after them, and so they would try to run. And they would hide in the deep canyon country, and there was a really good reason for them to want to run and not be arrested, because at that time period, active members of the church were not allowed to serve on juries. So if these men were arrested, chances were pretty good they were going to be convicted. And if they were convicted, they could be imprisoned up to 5 years. Their property could be taken from them. Their businesses could be taken from them. They were made to pay pretty steep fines. And this is in a real bind, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these men would try to get to places where they knew that they could be safely hidden. And one of these places was Floral Ranch, which is close to the small town of Junction, which is the setting of the book. And evidence indicates that these men went through Junction to get to Floral Ranch. And so that's exactly what happens in the book. And I'm just fascinated by people who are pretty much going about their everyday business, but they get caught up in something that's bigger than themselves. And in the book, they get involved. They're involved with helping people who are charged with a felony, and this is a great peril to themselves, because if you're, you know, aiding a felon, you can be arrested as well. And so that's the overall arc of the book. But at the same time, Deborah, the person who has tells part of the story, her husband has gone missing. And so she's got this anxiety and worry about what has happened to him. And you know, Vic, the fun part about writing historical fiction is the understanding that communication was very different then than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you could go a long spell and not hear from somebody. And you don't really know exactly what road or path they're taking. And so there was a lot of uncertainty. She doesn't know what's going on with him. Meanwhile, and it's not spoiling anything in the book, it's right up front. Meanwhile, she ends up helping a man who comes to her who's trying to run from the law. So those are the themes of what's going on in the story.
For those of you out there listening who have been born in the last 20 years, there was no text messaging going on. My guest is Anne Weisgarber. The book is The Glove Maker, and we get a lot of history of the Mormons here. I didn't realize just how badly they've been persecuted and driven out of various areas further east.
Right. That was a shock to me, too, because I'm not a member of the church, and you know, I grew up in Ohio. This was not part of our, you know, history books. But, yes, the Mormons have a long history of being persecuted, being chased. You know, the church was founded in New York. For a while, Joseph Smith, who was the founder, he was in Ohio, Kirtland, Ohio. They started to build a temple there. They got driven out of there. They went to Missouri, where the governor issued a statement that people who were Mormons should be treated as the enemies. As the enemy, and it was okay to kill them. So they were driven out of Missouri. They went to Illinois. That's where Joseph Smith, their founder, was killed. And they got driven out of Illinois. They ended up in Nebraska for a while. And then finally the Salt Lake City area in Utah. Yeah, it's a piece of history that has just been overlooked. Now, people in Utah know it. But many of us do not.
And there's also something in your book that I assume is based on a real historical event, but apparently there was a terrible massacre that was perpetrated possibly yes. by the Mormons disguised as Native Americans. Did this yes. really happen?
It did happen. It did happen. This was the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and it happened in 1857, and it was a wagon train coming from Arkansas, and they were on their way to California, as you know, many wagon trains were in the day, and they made the mistake of kind of laying over to replenish supplies and get their energy back in southwest Utah. And there were about 130 of them in this wagon party. And the reason I say they made a mistake is by doing that was because in 1857, this was when the president of the United States, James Buchanan, had decided that Utah was rebelling against the United States government, and he was sending troops to Utah. He was planning to take over the state. And, of course, the people in Utah were panicked, frightened, rumors, and they thought everybody was a spy. And as these troops were, you know, marching towards Utah, and this wagon train happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, rumors were wild. There was, like, hysteria. And, yes, it's pretty clear that members of the church massacred about 120 people. They dressed up to look like they were Native Americans, but the disguise didn't fool anybody. Mm-hmm. The survivors, there were a handful of children under the ages of six, or age of six, that they were spared, and these children were taken by the Mormons and kind of hidden in their homes. And then the relatives in Arkansas were screaming. They wanted those children back. They wanted to know what had happened. And it was years before anybody, and just one person was prosecuted for supposedly killing 120 people. So it's a tragic history that the church has had a hard time coping with, the modern church even today. But yes, Vic, I mean, I had no idea. I stumbled across this while I was doing research.
Yes, James Buchanan, who will be remembered as one of our truly great presidents. My guest is Anne Weisgarber. Her book is The Glove Maker. And we've got the drama in the book of the missing husband, the wheelwright. And Deborah is missing him all through the story. She's sad. She's disconsolate. She's worried. And we have the melodrama of what you've described as these felons who are married to more than one wife, who are hiding from the government and passing through this area, which, strangely, it's ironic that these are people who are supposedly fallen away from the church, yet some of them are willing to protect and hide these fugitives who are practicing something which, according to my understanding of your book, was a sacred practice of the church.
Yes. 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 So, it was such a complicated time for this community. And so there is a lot going on because, you know, typically when you're writing fiction, you know, there's all the kind of the outside influences that can hit people. But then people are also dealing with their own personal influences. And so I've got this, what's going on with the federal government and them getting involved with helping while the worry is ongoing about where her own husband is gone. But I really enjoyed thinking about the question of when do you help somebody? And even if you think what they have done is wrong, do you turn your back on them? Do you turn them in? And when I was playing with this whole idea, I was thinking about people who might have a family member who has done something terrible. And family members are placed in a position of maybe turning them into the police or helping to hide them. Mm-hmm. And so that was and the whole question began to haunt me about when do you turn your back on somebody who could be your brother or your father. And so there was all that. It was you know, a huge moral quandary that people were placed in. And I think the interesting little fact that I discovered along the way is by the 1880s, only about 25% of the men in the church had more than one wife. So that meant 75% did not. And I think that's, we kind of have the myth that they all had many, many wives.
Mm-hmm.
And the great majority of the people who did have more than one wife had two wives, not 20 wives, as, mm-hmm. you know, we kind of have that image.
Yeah.
So, and yes, the idea of practicing plural marriage was considered sacred. It was part of their religion. And again, that whole question of if this is somebody's faith, you know, how do we judge that?
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about your other narrator. He's the Swede. His name is Nels.
Uh-huh.
This is a passionate man.
Yes, and he is also loosely based on a real person who did exist. And he was one of the first people to come to the Junction area. And he came with his brother, and then his brother, the historic brother, left. And then he's alone for a while until another family shows up a few months later that's historically accurate. But, you know, he is a man who has doubts about the church, has pretty much left the church. And he's placed in this position of helping these felons. And the man who has gone missing, his name is Samuel, Deborah's husband, happens to be his stepbrother.
Mm-hmm.
His father was married to, it's confusing, his father had two wives and one, and so that's how these stepbrothers come to be together. So, yes, and he is a man who seems to me to be typical of the Western man, of just really wanting to be left alone so he can go about his business, but he can't be left alone. He gets caught up in this drama, and he's also involved with trying to find out what happened to Deborah's husband.
And he's got a really great dog.
He has such a good dog. You know, Vic, I have to have a dog in my book.
Uh-huh.
Books. I just, all my books have dogs. And I, you know, I have a friend who writes mysteries, and he told me, he said, whatever you do, don't ever let anything bad happen to the family dog, or readers will not like you. So the dog is, you know, I love that dog.
Great dog.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been speaking with Anne Weisgarber about her new novel, The Glove Maker. We are recording this in advance. She's in Houston, Texas right now, but as you're listening to this, she is preparing to be in downtown Dayton this afternoon. She's got an event at the Dayton Metro Library. That's at 215 East 3rd Street. She and Jess Montgomery are going to be talking about their new books, and that's at the Eichelberger Forum in the beautiful new Dayton Metro Library, 2 o'clock this afternoon. And they do ask you to let them know if you're planning to attend. Advance registration is appreciated, and you can do that online. Of course, there's no charge for this. You just might want to let them know you're going so they have enough chairs for you. It's daytonmetrolibrary.org/events, or you can call them at 463-2665. That's this afternoon, February 9th, at the Dayton Metro Library Eichelberger Forum. Anne Weisgarber and Jess Montgomery together, just for you, in downtown Dayton. Are you looking forward to that?
Oh, I am. I am so excited about it. I am so excited. I think, you know, Jess is just a lot of fun, and, you know, we don't take ourselves all that seriously, but we take our writing very seriously. So it's going to be a good time, but I think, you know, hopefully people will get something from it that they couldn't find anywhere else but at the library. And as you said, it is free, so the price is right.
And I'm picturing the two of you sitting there afterwards with these great big stacks of books and people lined up waiting for you to sign them.
We're hoping so, because as far as I know, Books & Co. will be there.
Okay.
Handling the sales for us.
Well, Anne, we really appreciate your time.
Well, Vic, thank you. This has been just a real pleasure.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it was a pleasure to talk to Anne Weisgarber about her new novel, The Glove Maker. Don't go away. We've got a little extra time for the final segment today, and we're going to bring you a surprise, Best of the Book Nook segment from 1999, right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. In our final segment today, we're going to go into our Book Nook archive and pull out an interview I recorded 20 years ago with a writer who made his reputation creating television programs. His name was Stephen Cannell. He died a few years ago. Stephen had his own TV studios. He developed programs like The Rockford Files and The A-Team. And he finally got tired of the way the networks were dealing with his studio. And he sold it for $500 million and started a new career as a novelist. Steve Cannell had battled dyslexia his entire life. And he battled the bestseller list, trying to gain traction as a novelist. He didn't enjoy the success as a fiction writer that he had gotten as a TV creator, but he never gave up. Let's listen now to Stephen Cannell from my third interview with him, recorded back in 1999. Tell us how you got the idea.
Well, it's funny how you get your ideas to write novels you know, I sometimes circle an idea for quite a while, and this one started in a very strange way. I started out, I read an article in the L.A. Times about a group of homicidal train riders known as FTRAs. That stands for Freight Train Riders of America, and they were actually started, they're sort of like a biker gang on the rails, only there's no initiation. If you say you're a bad guy and you're willing to kill on the spot anybody that's in your car, you're just an FTRA. And these guys do get tattoos on their arms that say FTRA. And the federal government, according to this article, estimates that these FTRAs have committed over 1,000 murders. And the, Ramirez, you know, the guy that was just riding around and they couldn't catch, you know, might well have been one. I was following a trial through this article up in Sacramento through the Sacramento Bee of a guy named Joe Silvera who had killed like 13 people, had just murdered guys on rail cars, other hobos, and who was a hobo. And Silvera was. And I thought, you know, I'd done one serial killer book, The Final Victim, and I thought, well, maybe I'll write another one. I don't like to cross the same terrain, but there was something very fascinating about the idea that there was no police force on the rails, that the federal government, nor the state government, nor the municipal police, none of these operations police the rails, that in fact they're policed by a bunch of plastic badges by the that work for Southern Pacific Railroad or what have you, and that in fact that these guys travel around with phony names and no ID basically are traveling like ghosts through our country, unable to be captured and moving from state to state, and actually right across the border into Mexico without any checks. And so the more I researched it, and I started buying books on hobos, and I thought I'd do this real textual piece about hobos and the world of the hobo today, and kind of a throwback in a way to the novels that you might have read about that in the 30s or 40s, because hoboing started back then, or even before. And I circled, and I did a lot of research. I spent probably a month. I was finishing up another book when I started looking at this, and I think I was just doing the final edits on Riding the Snake, But the more I looked at it, Vic, you know, the more I thought, I don't know that there's a novel here. And maybe I was a little put off by, I didn't want to write another serial killer book. And I thought, well, so I chucked it. Now I had like a lot of research and all these stories on the FTRAs. And I just put it aside. I said, you know what, maybe later I'll find something this goes with. But right now it doesn't feel like it's a book. So I started looking again, and something drew me to bioweaponry, and I don't know what. You know, I mean, I work sometimes when I'm looking for a new novel to write. I'll look on the internet for ideas and kind of hunt around and surf news stories and what have you. And I got into bioweaponry and, you know, and I thought, and I wasn't really at the very beginning all that fascinated by that, but I continued to download stories about it and kind of surf along the stuff I was finding on bioweaponry. And all of a sudden, because the one thing I didn't want to do was a story about Arab terrorists and stuff like that. I've been there, seen that, done that. I mean, you know, I didn't want to write that. So all of a sudden, I'm starting to realize that there's some pretty strange stuff happening at Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is where our bioweapons program was located until it was shut down by President Nixon in 1972. Up until then, we were offensively developing chemical weapons primarily. Now, the difference between a bioweapon and a chemical weapon is that a bioweapon is anything that has that's a protein or involves DNA, and everything else is a chemical weapon. So back then, we'd been developing anthrax and different chemical weapons, and the program had been shut down, and Fort Detrick had been where it was headquartered. But I was beginning to read stuff about congressional testimony that, and I always, when you're looking on the internet, you have to be a little careful because there's a lot of paranoia on the internet, and, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy stuff that may not be all that accurate. But when you're reading congressional testimony in front of the Armed Services Committees, you figure it's really happening. And these were I was reading testimony where these guys from Fort Detrick who were working on our now, quote, defensive bioweapons program, no longer offensive, were dragged to the Hill to try and explain why underground rooms of sarin and anthrax had been found at Fort Detrick with 300 and 400 pounds of each substance in the rooms. Now you know an aerosol can of anthrax would kill the whole city of New York. So why do you have enough anthrax to annihilate the entire planet several times over? And these guys, they'd say, we have to have it to make our antitoxins if we should be attacked by Arab terrorists. You go, yeah, but 400 pounds. It was obvious that they were stockpiling it. Even more nefarious things, became part of my research. And I began to realize that it was a very distinct possibility that our federal government was, in fact, doing this and that it was being funded off the books because it was supposed to be, we weren't supposed to be in it. And that the way, in fact, it was being funded was that the Pentagon was investing in the science programs of universities. And they were giving money to these science programs and then drawing off the microbiologists who were the stars of those science programs and saying, we want to fund your research at Fort Detrick and you'll work on some segment of science that, strangely enough, all seemed to sort of center around microbiology because it was the microbiology departments I was obviously looking at. I ran across a very strange project called the Genome Diversity Project, which I couldn't understand for the life of me why we were involved in the Genome Diversity Project. What that was, and again, at this point, it was all just sort of out there. You know, I mean, I wasn't trying to lock it up into anything. The Genome Diversity Project is still being run, by the way, by the CIA, and the Army Medical Corps is performing the on-site work. What it is that they are collecting blood and tissue samples from indigenous people all over the world, Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, Arabs, Jews, African-Americans, American Indians, Africans, just every genetic group, and storing this stuff. And it's all, and what ended up happening was that a tribe of American Indians who had had their blood and tissue sample taken and thought that it was in the tribal hospital, in fact found out that it had been sent to Fort Detrick, Maryland, and they filed a lawsuit. And that's what generated all these stories about the Genome Diversity Project, because this lawsuit made the papers. again, what were they doing? Why were they collecting this stuff? Well, their answer would, you know, was that we have to collect all these different genomes so that if any sort of plague or disease breaks out in any particular segment of a population, we will have the banks, the research banks, to deal with it. I think another very possible idea might be that if you were developing a bioweapon, it would not be as effective if it just hit anybody, but if you could genetically target it, it could be immensely effective. If you could genetically target it so it only hit, for instance, if you were at war with Saddam Hussein, only hit Arabs. If you could genetically target it so that it would only hit if we're at war against China, which my last book speculates might be where we're headed, you know, it might be really effective if it would only hit Chinese, if you were fighting the Chinese. So what we're really now talking about is ethnic cleansing. We're talking about genocide. This is pretty frightening stuff, I thought, you know, and so I began to deal with and plot the idea that I had I always get to a certain point and I start to work on my characters and who are the characters, and I have an admiral, two-star admiral named James G. Zoll, and he is a bio-warrior. He believes that bioweaponry is far superior to nuclear weaponry. He believes that our government has been left in the dust by signing this non-proliferation agreement in 72, that our enemies are all developing these future generations of bioweapons, that bioweapons are superior to nuclear weapons in his thinking for a variety of reasons, the key ones being that they don't pollute the environment, that they attack people only, that if you're trying to take an enemy city with a bioweapon, that you won't turn it into a pile of smoking radioactive rubble like you will with a nuclear device, but in fact, the next day you can drive on the freeways and the phones all work. And so what he is not contemplating, however, is the damage that it might do and most probably will do to our race, to the human race, because we will be forced as biological entities to mutate to accommodate this kind of an attack on our species. And who knows what will happen and what kind of changes will be produced by the use of this stuff if it ever becomes a real weapon of mass destruction that's being used around the world. And that's the fear, obviously, of bioweapons, not that nuclear weapons are superior. They're equally as bad, but I mean, we're just adding to the horror factor, I think, by having a whole nother thing that we are developing. And so I get to a certain point, and I've got I'm calling my underground lab at Fort Detrick the Devil's Workshop, where they're making all of this stuff, new generations of bioweapons. So then I got in touch with a guy named Peter Hazeltine, who was the head of the microbiology unit at USC, Dr. Hazeltine. He agreed to act as my technical advisor. And I started sitting down sort of telling him what I wanted to do. He gave me a lot of information on how the Pentagon and the government funds university biology projects or projects in general where they need information back from the – oh, I found out, by the way, that Sam Houston University was very big, was running a science pod in Huntsville, Texas, where they were testing biology experiments for the government on prisoners. Just a whole lot of stuff that was like – unclean, you know. It's just, you look at it and you say, this is very strange. So, and I told him I don't want to do anthrax and sarin because we've been there and done that, seen that. I wanted my novel to be as much on the cutting edge as possible. And he said, well, do you know anything about prions? And I said, I never heard of them before. And he said, well, they're proteins. They're rogue proteins that are not ingested by your stomach enzymes and, in fact, go right on into your bloodstream. And what they tend to do is attack your midbrain, which is where your mood center is. And they create a disease or a situation known as spongiform encephalitis, which is basically what it sounds like. It's an expanding of the brain, turning it into a sponge, eating holes into it of the midbrain. and that's your mood center. And what it really is, the bovine equivalent of this is mad cow disease. And we know that those cows go insane before they die, and then they die horrible deaths. And there have been instances of human human situations where this has happened.
Kuru, the foray
mm-hmm. Indians mm-hmm. In New Zealand.
And that was from cannibalism.
It was from cannibalism. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to read a book called The Deadly Feast, which was all about Kuru and Dr. Carl Gajdacek, who had discovered this protein and named it.
Now, isn't he the one that got in trouble here recently?
He enjoyed living with the Indians.
Okay. I thought the name was familiar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but that he was a Nobel laureate, but he had a problem. All of this started to gel into a book in my mind, and then I was sitting one morning and I'm thinking, you know, because if I'm going to tell a story about microbiology and bioweaponry, I need this to get out of the hands of the people who are husbanding it. It needs to get loose, and I don't want it just to get loose in a very general sense. It needs to be in the hands of somebody who's going to use it for ill in a way that will be terrifying and demonstrate my premise of my book that we shouldn't be messing with this stuff. And it occurred to me that my FTRAs were the perfect group, that they can travel around the country with, and nobody can catch them, and so I created a wonderful character named Fannin Kincaid, who I modeled after John Brown from Harper's Ferry, this kind of wild-eyed zealot of a guy, a preacher who preached hatred and racism, and
it's got a little worse language than John Brown, though.
Well, John Brown, yeah, I mean he's an ex-Vietnam vet who was basically, which all these FTRAs, when they started, it was post-Vietnam, and it started in a bar in Texas right after the war, and it was eight guys that came together, and they couldn't get jobs, and they were angry, and they were called baby killers in the street, and they couldn't wear their uniforms, and they became FTRAs, and that's where it all started. So this guy was one of the founders I made up, and he was a colonel in Vietnam, and now he's in his religious moments he's a zealot, and in his angry moments he curses like a sailor. You know, he's a wonderful insane character. I mean, he is legally insane in my mind. He's a man who is completely running on fumes. But
like a lot of insane people, he's very charismatic.
Oh, charismatic.
He's got the Hitler thing going.
Yeah, he's charismatic mm-hmm. and overpowering and intense.
And a racist and a white supremacist.
And white supremacist and all of it, yeah.
And a nut for certain books of the Bible.
Yeah, Revelations primarily. I mean, I find one of the things that surprised me was that whenever you see these cults and you begin to realize what they're preaching, it's all out of one book, which is Revelation.
You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO with the late Stephen Cannell talking about his 1999 novel, The Devil's Workshop. Steve died a few years ago, and he was a larger-than-life kind of guy. He was very tall. He was an extravagant dresser. I'll never forget the last time I saw him. I was in Los Angeles at a publishing conference in 2008, and he was in one of the booths signing autographs, and he offered to take some of us to lunch. We went outside of the Staples Center in Los Angeles and waited for our ride to pick us up. A limousine pulled up to the curb, and the plate said, Hef 1. I started walking towards it, and Steve said, no, that's not my limo. It opened up, and a woman who must have been a Playboy bunny came out with her arm around Hugh Hefner, the creator of Playboy magazine. The second Steve saw Hugh Hefner, he said, Hef! And he ran up to him and shook his hand and began chatting with him. And then about 20 seconds later, Steve Cannell's limousine pulled up to pick us up. And we had a nice lunch in Los Angeles that day with Steve Cannell, the creator of programs like the Rockford Files. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.